From the get-go, she was confident and fun and feisty. She always had these big blue eyes open wide, and these little curls were always flying behind her because she was always running. I mean, even now, I can see her running across the room and jumping up in my lap. And I can still close my eyes, and I can feel those little curls right here, and I can smell her little baby skin.
Randy May Brewer.
Gina Wilson Green.
Geraldine Barr DeSoto.
Charlotte Murray Pace.
Diane Alexander.
Pamela Kinnamore.
Trenisha Dene Colombe.
Carrie Lynn Yoda.
Connie Lynn Warner.
Michelle Chapman and her boyfriend.
Eugenie Boisfontaine.
Christine Moore.
Mari Ann Fowler.
Eleanor Parker.
Glenn Tankersley.
Melinda McGee.
Colette Walker.
Jacqueline Denise Sims and her two children.
Cassandra Green. Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clementi, former New York City prosecutor, retired FBI profiler, and writer-producer on CBS's Criminal Minds. With me today from London is...
Laura Richards, criminal behavioral analyst, activist, and advocate, and founder of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service.
And I am Lisa Zambetti. I am the casting director for Criminal Minds, where Jim Clementi is my colleague, and I have a real interest in real crime and the minds that solve those crimes.
Today we're going to be talking about another Bayou killer. That is a person we're going to refer to as DL. The killings all occurred around the Baton Rouge area, and there are many, many victims once again.
Yeah, there are about 19 names that we read. Some of them are known and DNA linked to this killer, and some are ones that we strongly suspect are his victims.
And some are victims of domestic violence or victims of attacks that were not murdered, or children that may have been victimized through domestic violence or have been forced to witness it. We believe they're all victims of DL, and so we want to give all these victims a voice.
So this is a case really where we need to make the links of somebody who's dangerous and predatory inside the home in their own relationships. He was very prolific in terms of domestic violence and stalking behavior and was a risk to women, but also to women outside the home. And a lot of times people don't make those links. So it's important for us for the learning here. We're not going to talk about the killer in terms of his name, but it is important to learn and understand that this was actually something that happened over many years, and many women were targeted by him. And this really, outside the home, this really was a long-term predatory stalker who spent time surveilling his victims, many of whom said that they were being watched before they were killed.
For me, what's really striking about this case, the more that I looked into it, Laura and Jim, is how differently this victim pool was treated than our previous case, the victims of RD. I mean, it's just so striking, and I know that we're going to get into that. But yeah, that's what struck me.
Well, certainly this victim pool, when it was discovered that there was a serial killer operating, that victim pool was much more covered and in the media, and they actually had money to put up rewards and things like that. So it was definitely treated differently in that respect. But it's also still troubling that it was well into this series of killings that the police really were on to the fact that there was actually a serial killer responsible for these and many more crimes.
I'd definitely say that there were so many opportunities for intervention and prevention far earlier on, because women in his significant life, in his partners, were reporting domestic violence to the police, and other women were reporting stalking, and he was named and he was picked out of lineups, and he was understood to be a peeping Tom and a danger to women. And many times he was in and out of police custody just with a slap on the wrist, and domestic violence and stalking was not taken seriously. So I actually think that yet again, there's been a huge failure around understanding the risk and danger that someone presents.
Right. And the thing is that he had a long history of arrests and convictions for these nuisance crimes, these precursor crimes to rape and homicide. And yet, again and again and again, I think it may have been because he did have an outgoing personality. He was articulate. He could talk his way out of things.
You mean charming?
Yeah, I do mean that. Isn't that charming and glib a very important aspect of psychopathy?
Absolutely. And that's what people said about him, that he was very charming and charismatic when he wanted to be. But he was offending from the age of 11. And, you know, with this peeping Tom, watching girls and women, as we know, is a gateway offence, and torturing animals and doing the things that he did. And yet no one's joining the dots, even in this local area. So, you know, certainly with the case we last covered, we know that the victims weren't linked. And in this case, it still took a very long time to link these cases. And a task force was set up after 53 women were found brutally murdered in Baton Rouge across 1991 and 2001, and the task force was set up in August 2002. So I don't feel that these victims were understood to be linked. I don't think that when you look at the case and you understand the type of victims that were being targeted and the bodies that were turning up, and of course some victims are still missing, and we'll talk about that, but I still feel that because things weren't being taken seriously, from sexual violence, stalking, domestic violence, peeping, that none of this was joined up. And sadly, too many women lost their lives, and some of them have never been found. So shall we start talking through each case and going through exactly what happened? And of course, sometimes it's out of sequence because DNA gets linked later on. But I think it would be great if we can go through each victim and explain what happened.
Yeah, absolutely. And when you do look up this crime, you know, there are certain victims that are sort of focused on. But what I really love about your research, Laura, is you've really dug into, you know, the first victim we're going to talk about, you know, doesn't really even come up when you do a search on DL and the women he was actually charged with murdering. So do you want to talk about Randy?
We always talk about victimology, and certainly the victim selection and victimology holds a mirror up to the perpetrator. And he did choose relatively low risk victims, but they were high risk in terms of what he was doing, which tells us a lot about his criminal career and his ability to get away with things. Randy Mabrua was a young mother who was relatively recently divorced. And on April the 18th, 1998, she had been out with her three-year-old son to the local video store. This is in Zachary. And she had gone out presumably to hire or rent a video. And she basically came back home at about 7 o'clock. And what happens next is not known, other than in the morning, the little boy, the three-year-old, woke up and he goes into his mummy's bedroom and she's not there. And he goes outside and he raises the alarm, tells a neighbor that he can't find his mummy. And the neighbors go round there and they find blood at the home address, at her home address. And that's really as much as they knew. There were signs of a struggle as well. And effectively, there was blood that was found at the house, which was later DNA matched. But sadly, her body has never been found.
First of all, it's a terrible tragedy that her three-year-old had to discover that and was left without a mother as a result of that. It's just, but the fact that her body was never found, it's clear that this guy had some level of criminal sophistication and he knew how to get rid of bodies effectively. And I think that's why I think as we go down that list, there was a number of victims that haven't been found. They may not have been completely tied to him because of the fact that the bodies weren't found. He was obviously somewhat criminally sophisticated in that he did make an attempt to at permanent concealment. And when that's the case, it's typically because there is evidence that he is linked to this person and that he's going to then take the additional risk of spending time with the person after the abduction and then also some time with the victim after they were dead because he had to ensure permanent concealment.
And this happened in Zachary, Louisiana, which is, you know, a smaller town outside of Baton Rouge. But what's interesting is that the lieutenant in the Zachary Police Department, he did suspect DL for this crime and, you know, wasn't able to arrest him for it. But all the way back then, this was a suspect. And it took many, many, many victims later before this same lieutenant was able to get attention to this suspect. So, you know, it's really devastating that this could have been solved a lot sooner. I mean,
when people, I have to just say this, when people complain about police departments and some of the things that they do and don't do, one of the biggest issues is manpower and budgets. I mean, if he suspected this guy and he had the manpower and the budget to put a tail on this guy, we may have been able to stop this whole series of murders from happening. I mean, like, isn't that what you were talking about, Laura? The opportunities at intervention and prevention?
Absolutely. And, you know, we've got to remember with Randy as well. I mean, she was 20 years old at the time. She was divorced. She had a child. She was very attractive, actually, as a female. Brown hair, brown eyes. She also worked in healthcare, and where she lived was practically next door to Connie Warner, who was another victim from earlier on, who had been murdered. And just proximity, there are some red flags with a case like this in terms of the type of victim, the victimology, as well as in terms of the proximity and the geography and what was happening to the women. So, and the fact that there was a sign of a struggle and there was a pink plastic bag in her carport which was stained with her blood, this showed that she was lightly assaulted in her home address and taken elsewhere. And, you know, perhaps it was about spending time with her. Perhaps it was also about the fact he knew that there was a son at the home address. But it certainly everything points to the fact, you know, across this series that he did do a lot of preparatory work in terms of surveilling women and, you know, could work out the risks. And he was, you know, in terms of his career, starting at the age of 11, it means that he's had a lot of practice at doing things. So, and targeting girls and women, not killing in every case. But I think it was in 2004 that the DNA, there was a DNA test that linked to DL. You know, in terms of her son, I mean, I can't imagine the trauma for him going into his mummy's room and not being able to find her. But he apparently has been raised by the ex-partner. And actually, it was the ex-partner who was the prime suspect in the case. The police concentrated their efforts on him, first of all, which actually tends to happen in a lot of cases. And that, again, is the reason why sometimes, you know, things fall through the cracks, because people are looking for the wrong type of perpetrator.
Do you know, Lisa, what the lieutenant said drew him to DL in this case?
That he had that track record, as Laura has said, of all those smaller crimes, that he had been a peeping Tom.
We call them nuisance offenses or precursor offenses, and those are things that typically lead up to this. You don't do a successful break-in abduction or break-in rape murder unless you've had some practice getting into homes, watching people, making sure you know their schedules, know where the threats are. And that's the kind of thing that it looks like was going on here. And especially since there are a lot of these women lived in close proximity to each other, that it was almost like he cast out a net, and whoever he saw nearby who fit his vulnerability, availability, and desirability characteristics, he would then offend against. But that is extremely high-risk behavior. You would think that once one person in that neighborhood was attacked or abducted or killed, that the alarms would be out, that the police would increase surveillance and presence in that neighborhood, and they'd be able to prevent further crimes. But here, it happened over and over and over again, didn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Even on the same street, houses apart, there were two, possibly three victims. Oh, I mean, what does that say to you guys about him? Like, he loves that thrill? Like, that adds to how he gets off on the crime? Or
I think, when we talk about offenders, they do have anchor points, you know, their own anchor points of their workplace, their homes, and places they feel comfortable. And when they first start offending, a lot of them remain within their hunting ground, if you like. And I think a lot of the earlier offences here, they're clustered around, you know, the Louisiana University, State University. A lot of the victims went to the university or they're in healthcare, and they do live very close. So I would imagine that he is spending time in these areas. And in fact, even where some of the victims were found, the deposition site where he left some victims was also in the same place. So, you know, and they were along routes that he would travel to work. So, you know, offenders do work on the principle of least effort too, where they work and operate where they feel comfortable, and then they may start to move out of those areas when they feel the risk is getting too much. And DL was one of those individuals who did change his jobs and did move areas relatively frequently, but he did go back to some of these hunting grounds.
So shall we move on now to the next victim that we think is in this timeline?
Gina Wilson-Green.
Yep, September 2001. Gina was 39 years old, and she was a nurse. So again, another healthcare element here. And she was raped and murdered in her home on Stamford Avenue in Baton Rouge on September the 23rd, 2001. And she was actually discovered on the next day, on September the 24th, by a co-worker who decided to check on her when she didn't turn up for work the next day. And it was determined that the cause of death was strangulation. And again, she was a very attractive white female. And she had actually told her mother and some of her friends weeks before that she was concerned that she was being watched. We'd say being stalked.
I have a detail here that the night before, her security system had gone off at around 3:47 a.m. But, you know, there was nobody there when she went to investigate. They didn't see anybody. So I'm just wondering if that was like a practice run for him.
Yeah, maybe he had to figure out where it was and disable it for the next night. But it's funny you mention following versus stalked. In one of the documentaries that I watched about this case, one of my colleagues had said that the difference between stalking and watching is that watching, the victim doesn't know, isn't aware, and stalking, the victim is aware. Is that always the case, Laura?
Well, I mean, it's always a challenge because so many victims, you know, you don't know that there's a problem until sort of later down the line. And certainly with pretty much every victim I've worked with, you know, there were lots of things going on that they just were not aware of. And then it was someone or something that tipped them off and they started asking questions. And then they found out actually there was far more that was happening. And we also know that victims tend to suffer 100 times before they tell the police. Mm-hmm. When stalking is happening. So, I mean, she did tell her mother and her friends as well, which of course a lot of people would talk to those around them first of all before they even consider telling the police. And it's what their response is that either makes them feel actually I should really probably report this or tell someone about it, or, you know, perhaps they think, well, I'm just maybe being a bit paranoid or a bit dramatic, and I'll just manage it myself.
But remember we talked to a colleague of mine who had discovered late in the game that one of the people he was confiding in at work who about the fact that he kept getting these nuisance communications and all that, that he didn't find out till later, like very much by chance, that this female had been stalking him at his home because the camera at the end of his block recorded her driving by his house something like 1,400 times in a 30-day period or something like that. And so he certainly was not aware of any of that. In fact, he was confiding in this person all the things that he did know about, crying on her shoulder, which is what probably fueled her to do more and more and more and more and more. She was the stalker.
But my question about that is, Laura, you know, isn't stalking, if you're letting the person know I am following you, isn't that sort of the sadistic way that you're torturing them, letting them know that you are following them and keeping track of them, whereas following is more anonymous, that they're...
Yeah, but I would call it pretext surveillance in the case where it's not. I'd say following is not a separate category. I think following is part of stalking. I think following is part of pretext surveillance. I think it has to do with the intent of the offender, and I don't think those are good, solid categories that you should differentiate whether they know or don't know, because much, as you said, Laura, much of stalking behavior is unknown to the victim, and it is simply something they find out later, maybe when it's too late.
Yeah, and we'd call this predatory stalking. You know, and his, as you say, Jim, you know, offenders are motivated by different things. So with him, he's motivated by, there's a sexual motivation here in terms of what he's doing. And so all of the surveillance side, you know, he's collecting information and he's probably very excited whilst watching these women. And then he's making a decision about when he's going to complete the actual act of when he's going to get into the house. But he does diversify his MO as well. But stalking, I mean, certainly, you know, having worked thousands of cases, you can have someone who's stalked for 7 years, 8 years, and what it started out as in terms of what was motivating it to what it is, you know, on the seventh or eighth year can be something quite different. And right. It might be they want a relationship, and then when they don't get that relationship, they want to take revenge. With him, when we look back at this case, it's very clear that he's a predatory stalker. And, you know, he has a real anger and rage issue towards women. And it is a power and control crime in terms of his targeting of a particular victim type that look a certain way.
Well, the next we're going to talk about Geralyn Barr DeSoto.
Pam will be dead a year, July the 12th. And I won't be able to say it. Last year she was here. Last year we did this. Last year we did that. That's really hard.
So we're talking about Geralyn Barr DeSoto, who is the third victim on our list of this particular serial rapist and serial killer.
So she was 21 years old at the time, and she was an LSU student, again, which we have seen with a number of the victims he targeted. But interestingly, she was married. And, you know, again, a number of these, the women that he targeted were married and did have husbands that they lived with and children. And she was due actually to attend a job interview the day that she disappeared and was actually killed. And she wanted to basically pay for her tuition at university. But she was brutally murdered and was stabbed to death and actually almost beheaded in her home, which was in just off of Highway 1 in Addis, Louisiana, which was just across the Mississippi River from Baton Rouge. And that was on January the 14th, 2002. And, you know, pretty horrific. Her husband goes home, Darren, and when he returns home from work that day, he finds her almost decapitated in his home address.
You know, I have to say at this point, just at this point, we're talking about the third victim. I don't understand why, just at this point, when something that horrific happens, when a wife is, young woman is brutally murdered inside her home, why isn't this something that raises all sorts of alarms, gets people to look at whether there are other cases like this around, and immediately puts up some sort of surveillance to try to determine what could have happened here, as well as preventing future cases. Instead, this is just the beginning of a rampage. And this is not, you know, back in the late 90s, this is 2002. There have been significant advances in crime scene reconstruction, in DNA analysis, and so forth. And I'm just at a loss for why this didn't raise all sorts of alarms, because clearly you have a situation where there is an extremely violent killer out there. Even if it were just this case alone, why didn't that, totally send off all the alarms?
No, they just, they suspected the husband, which that makes sense that they would think of him first as the first suspect.
You have to rule out the people closest, but why that much violence? Why that much just incredible? I mean, it obviously took a while. Obviously, this scene was very bloody. It makes very little sense that they would not still raise the alarm to the world, and in particular when you have other cases preceding this where somebody was raped and murdered in their home not too far away. It just makes no sense to me.
Exactly. And this level of violence and brutality, it's incredibly rare, for one. And we know in this area there is a lot going on, but these are low-risk victims, and this is an offender who is breaking into women's houses and brutally attacking them, raping them, and almost decapitating. So, I too am at a loss as to why there wasn't much more proactively being done. And in particular, he must have been someone who was relatively well-known because of his criminal history. This was a road, incidentally, that he would travel to, and where their house was, he would travel to and from work along this road. So again, just in terms of, anchor points, offenders do use this kind of principle of least effort and where he's most comfortable.
Yeah, and also it's a place where he could explain his presence. In other words, if he is on the way to and from work, he could pull off to the side of the road and say he had car trouble or that he had to take a leak or something if he was caught surveilling somebody in that neighborhood. There's an excuse, a reasonable excuse for why he was there. And that's another reason why they do hunt in places that they're familiar with.
Right. And we know that he can talk his way out of things. A number of people describe this kind of charisma, but extreme agitation and anger if he didn't get his way, this kind of Jekyll and Hyde. But there was certainly a particular victim pool or victim preferential type that he went for, and, in a particular area. And next, in terms of the next case that was DNA linked, was 22-year-old Charlotte Murray Pace. And actually, she was known by her friends and family as Murray. But she had just recently graduated from LSU just days before she was raped and stabbed to death again in her home on Shario Avenue in Baton Rouge on May the 31st, 2002. And she, interestingly, Jim, she had just moved from Stamford Avenue, which is where another victim, Gina Wilson Green, had been murdered. But she had really fought back. And, there were lots of defensive wounds on her. And she was stabbed 83 times with a flathead screwdriver in her own home.
Okay. And I have to say, so now you have another girl from LSU in the same age group, generally looking the same, just down the street from another victim. I mean, why isn't this entire neighborhood locked down? Why aren't there daily roadblock canvases? Because we know that offenders do operate, especially when you're having repeat crimes in the same neighborhood, that they do operate in places that they have to go through to and from. Why didn't they take down the names of everybody and then go and find that, oh, my God, this one guy, he has a history of breaking into houses. Oh, my God, he's done this kind of violent stuff before. That's just unconscionable to me. And that could have stopped it cold at victim number 4.
I just want to talk a little bit about Charlotte, because we do know a lot more about her because her mom has, been interviewed extensively and has talked about her. And You know, it's just so heartbreaking for me. I mean, she graduated from high school at 15 and she graduated from college at 20 and had her MBA by 22. And she was just devoted to her studies and had all these hopes and dreams. And she was just starting her life, you know, in her new apartment. And to have this happen, she's literally just ripped from her family, you know, for absolutely no reason. It's just, it's horrible. Not that any other victim, you know, it's not horrible for any other victim who doesn't look like her or from the same family type or economic status. But I mean, because we know so much about her and you can hear her mom talk about Charlotte as being a little girl with the sweetest little curls who would just jump into her lap and say, I love you, mommy. I mean, it just feels so much more present to me, you know, when you hear her mother talk about her.
And yeah, and her friends all saying how her personality was so outgoing, how her life, she was so full of life. It's just such a shame. And this is the kind of thing, I know you felt it too, Laura, during the course of your career, but this was the hardest part of my job, when you get to know these victims, because the first thing we do is study victimology on any case, and you get to know everything about their lives and their dreams and their hopes and their families, but you know something horrible happened to them and that their dreams were crushed and their families were devastated. And it's just, it's a weight that keeps building up over the course of your career. And so I really am glad that we're able to talk today about her and these other victims, about their lives and about their families, because it's such a tragedy. It's the only good thing about this, that we can remember them and give them back their voice.
I mean, certainly she, you know, I agree with everything you say, and her life being cut so short. She was also the youngest person ever to receive an MBA in business administration from the university. So she was clearly, you know, not just everyone who always said about what a big friendly smile she had and how beautiful she was and how smart she was, but the fact that, you know, she's really kind of out there, outstanding in her own peer group. You know, and again, you know, is this someone in terms of the perpetrator where he'd spent a lot of time surveilling her and knowing who she was, the kind of the unobtainable to him in a way, the person who he exacts outrage on? I mean, to stab someone 83 times, you know, really is overkill. And she, it sounds like, you know, was non-compliant. And really did fight for her life. And it was just such a brutal attack. You know, and the fact that she had moved from an area, Stamford Avenue, which is where a number of the other offences are as well.
Right. That's what I was thinking. Did he watch her so closely that he saw her moving and followed her to her new house? I mean, that's terrifying.
Well, that's what happens with a predatory stalker. And you know, my sense from researching this case and spending a fair amount of time on it, you know, he is one of the most dangerous types of offenders. And in fact, you know, the only times where he wasn't abusing or raping or killing was the short spells that he was in prison. So, and they were very short spells because he literally got a slap on the wrist each time. And then he was cut loose again to spend his time, you know, in a predatory way. But incidentally, still playing a family father, a kind of a family man, by, you know, kind of leading this dual life where he took his kids out and would do family outings. But the other side to his life was that he would spend a lot of time watching, waiting and planning. And I certainly think, you know, his levels of fixation, it was all about particular types of women that he went for. And he would spend a lot of hours watching them. And I, you know, would opine that he probably did follow her. It certainly doesn't seem to be any coincidence in terms of the, you know, the proximity of where each of these women had lived and how close they were to other victims, not only where they were attacked, but also where they were found. And that's certainly not coincidental.
And this seems different for listeners, if you want to go back and listen to our previous episodes about the Killing Bayous. This seems very different from RD's victim pool, who seemed like opportunistic, like he wasn't stalking those boys. He would just see them and have an impulse to take them. It seems like DL was in it for the long game. I mean, he seemed to have a lot of patience
He certainly would have patience and time. You know, he chose a particular victim at a particular time, in a particular place, in a particular manner, for a particular purpose. And he really does, exemplify, someone who is prepared to wait and spend that time. And, you always have to match across the matrix of, about victims' availability, their desirability, their vulnerability, and the opportunity. And he would absolutely wait for the right time. And the desirability part, there was absolutely that aspect with the majority of the victims that he chose. And I know that there are some other victims that he targeted that we'll talk about that might look quite different. And I would also suggest, I don't know what your view on this, Jim, is, but I think RD did spend, in our previous case, some time, but not in every case. And, it's very difficult to know, really. You never get the true timeline of how perpetrators select victims and how much time they spent when they are serial. And they are so prolific, and particularly when there are so many knowledge gaps about the victims and the timeline and sequence of events. But I certainly think with some of RD's victims, he did spend some time and some preparatory behaviour. But you're right, Lisa, DL seems to be much more targeted and specific. What do you think, Jim?
Well, I think that it was RD definitely were sexually fantasy-based crimes. I think that he definitely spent a lot of time fantasizing about his next victims. I think he may have not had the patience or the ability to know when a particular victim might become vulnerable, though. And I think he had to sort of go by potluck because he was picking up victims off the street, not at their homes. He was taking people who were engaged in high-risk behaviors. And so there isn't a need for the predatory stalking in advance because these people are out in public and they come to him, so to speak. And that means that he doesn't have to be as sophisticated criminally as DL did have to be. So I think the natures of the crimes, and that's how profiling works, it's the nature of the crime, the behavior itself, that tells us what kind of person is doing it and why and how they're accomplishing it. So DL did something that was very high risk for him because he was going at victims where they had the most amount of security in the privacy of their own homes. And so it took more sophistication, even though they both used ruses. And I think that RD's ruse was very personality driven. In other words, he used his personality to lower the defenses of his potential victims in much the same way that DL did, just a different kind of ruse. But I think RD had some, additional skills when he got close to somebody. He was able to play the role of victim. He was able to play the role of really a helpless person. Whereas I think DL was more of a kind of a smooth-talking, charismatic person, and he was able to lower somebody else's inhibitions by just presenting as such a nice guy. But I don't think at all that he played the victim role. Well, this sounds like a good time to take a break to hear a word from our sponsors.
It's difficult circumstances to be here, but we felt it was important.
Dave Yoder's daughter, Carrie Lynn, became the serial killer's fifth victim, the most recent.
Everyone is at a different stage in this process. It's only been 10 weeks, 11 weeks for us, so the folks that have been at this for a year and a half are a totally different stage of grieving.
Many people did say that he would wear quite dapper clothes, and he played that part of wearing smart clothes and being charismatic. And of course, in a couple of the cases, we know that the attack wasn't successful. And when you talk about ruses, in the next case, which actually ends up being much more significant later on through DNA, but in the sequence, it actually wasn't even linked for some time. But on June the 9th, 2002, there was a lady called Diane Alexander who answered a knock at the door, And before her was a man who asked, could he use her phone book and phone? And he also asked her about her husband and whether he was home. And she said that no, he wasn't. And then he managed to force his way into the address and actually tried to strangle her with the telephone cord out of the wall. And he beat her. Unfortunately for her, her son came home, and obviously him coming home interrupted the attack. And I would call this a near miss. She was very, very lucky that she wasn't killed. And the perpetrator then fled in his gold Mitsubishi. And it wasn't until later on in 2003 that it was linked and it was traced to DL. So it's almost 1 year goes by. But of course, what it tells us is his ability to use a confidence approach and going to a house, and he's very confident in that approach, and it's clearly worked for him many times.
Right. And you mentioned some other things that are really important here, and I think that one of the things that confounded or confused law enforcement was the multiplicity of weapons and violence, the levels of violence that were used in these cases. It was all over the board. But to me, that just tells me he's a disorganized offender. So even though he's sophisticated enough to get into homes that are occupied and sophisticated enough to use a ruse to get himself inside, he uses weapons of opportunity, things that he finds in the crime scene. He doesn't bring a particular weapon with him and use that all the time. He's stabbing with screwdrivers and choking with electrical cords and hitting over the head with irons that he finds in the location. And that means that he's prepared if he does get stopped to where he doesn't have to have a weapon on him that might look bad and may tie him to these crimes. It's sort of a criminal sophistication, disorganization at the same time. And I think that this is this type of case is why at the behavioral analysis unit we stopped just using only disorganized and organized as offenders and started talking about mixed offenders. Offenders who have aspects of organization and disorganization. I think DL is a good example of that.
Other things that may have confused the police is that Diane Alexander was African American. She lived 60 miles away from Baton Rouge and Brobridge. A couple other details about the way she was attacked. He told her when he came in that I've been watching you. So again, it looks like Laura, he'd been stalking, following, surveilling her for quite a while. And an interesting thing is he did try to rape her, but was unable to perform. And I think you've talked about that before, haven't you, Jim?
Well, it's interesting you say that because in another report I found, they said that as he was raping her, he whispered that in her ear. So I'm not sure which is accurate, okay. But what I have talked about, and you know, there's a spectrum of behavior here, but there are some offenders who are not able to perform sexually, which is why they choose to do this kind of crime. There are others that are very much turned on by the fact that the victim is helpless. So I'm not sure what happened in this case with DL, but to me, it is possible that that the victim did not give all the details of what happened or was very reluctant about it. The information that I had, though, was that it was a rape in progress when her son came home.
And the other thing just to note is that, you know, when people do rape or are sexually violent, it doesn't mean to say they ejaculate in every case as well, semen not being left. And it's not an inverted commas kind of complete offence, because this was interrupted. You know, and we know in other cases that semen wasn't found, and that doesn't mean to say that there wasn't a sexual element to it. But, you know, things are dynamic. People can interrupt. There can be the fantasy reality. Someone can say something, you know, and lots of things can go on. So, you know, again, I think it's certainly an interesting near miss. And she's written a book, actually. I haven't had time to read it, but it's called Divine Justice. I think she was, you know, in one sense, an incredibly lucky lady that her son came home at the time. You know, not lucky because she was attacked or raped or violated in that way, but because her son appeared at that critical time.
Right. And I think also she was a crucial witness for this case. She was not discovered as a victim until very late in the investigation, and at that point she did not want to cooperate, but eventually, after being told what the investigator and the profiler that was involved in the case were trying to do, she did actually come forward. She was very strong, and she was able to provide evidence and a very good description, which changed the focus of the investigation. Because to that point, they had had one witness who saw a white pickup truck with a white guy driving it, driving down a road, and that near one of, where one of the victims was located, and therefore they were looking for a white offender up until that point. And so this changed the course of the investigation significantly, and it got more and more focused on DL until he was actually arrested.
And that's fascinating, you saying that, actually, Jim, because you probably found this too. I've certainly found in many serial rape cases that once a victim knows they're one of a number of victims, they're much more likely to want to give a statement and to come forward. Because, I mean, it's for lots of reasons, but the main one being that they know it's not just about them being targeted, and actually they want to do more to find this individual and make sure that other victims, you know, other people aren't victimized at their hands. And they actually become very determined to give evidence and in chief and give their statements.
Mm-hmm. It's a phenomenon that I believe I've seen in many, many of these cases, where the victims don't feel important enough by themselves to actually drive forward. But once they know there are other people, once they know that they can help protect future victims, and help put this person away, then they're emboldened to go forward. And it's sad, because one of the resultant effects of being sexually victimized is that your persona shrinks, that your self-confidence and your self image can be very much damaged. And hopefully, by coming forward and by being part of a group effort to put this person away, it helped undo some of the damage that was done during the course of this crime.
We're going to have to pause here with Diane Alexander's case. And next episode, when we come back, we're going to talk about the next victim that really made this case become headline news and was very differently handled by the police after this victim.
Well, as we close up this particular podcast, I want to basically let the families and friends and survivors of this particular serial rapist and serial killer know that our heart goes out to them, all of us here at Real Crime Profile. And I also want to ask our listening audience to remember these victims. And if any of you do know these victims personally and would like to reach out to us on Facebook or Twitter, we would love to hear from you. We would love to bring the victims back to life with their life stories. And we hope that that will bring some peace and joy to the families who fell victim to this horrific killer. Signing off on Real Crime Profile.
So if you want to help us out on the show, please can you go to wandry.com/survey and complete the little survey about us. And it shouldn't take more than 5 minutes. You can even do it from your phone. So that's wandry.com/survey. It will take you just a few minutes to complete, and it will really help us out, giving us some more information about you and why you listen to Real Crime Profile.
So if you enjoy our podcast and would like to support us, there are a couple of important things you can do. First, you can go over to iTunes and give us a positive 5-star review. You can check out our sponsors and take advantage of the special promotions for Real Crime Profile listeners. You can go over and like our Facebook page, and you can follow us on Twitter. But most importantly, you can share our podcast with friends, family, and anyone you know would be interested in real crime and the minds that solve those crimes. So thank you for listening.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineered by Terrell Parham. Music composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107, or you can go on the website www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic violence, call the National Domestic Violence Helpline free phone 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, safety, shelter or counselling, call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, 214 946 4357 or go on their website www.genesisshelter.org or the domestic violence hotline on 800 799 7233.
If you're a regular listener to the show, you know we have great brands like Blue Apron, Audible, and Casper advertising with us, and they keep coming back because our listeners really respond to them, which we're really thankful for. Well, if you happen to own a business or manage the advertising buy for one, then you should consider advertising on Real Crime Profile. Podcast advertising is on the rise, and it's one of the most effective ways of reaching consumers on the go today. So please go to wondery.com/advertisers. Again, it's wondery.com/advertisers. And get in touch with us. Thanks.